I'm Ehsan, it's Friday, and this is the Friday Show, brought to you from Stockport, Phil Foden's area. The title race is coming to an epic climax, and joining me to preview the game against Wolves and chat all manner of things, I've got two Friday Show stalwarts, Lloyd and George. Afternoon, George.
Good afternoon, Ehsan. How's it going?
It's going very, very, very fine. It's a bank holiday weekend. The sun is shining. Foden's getting all of the love that he deserves. I mean, you know, if Stockport is making the headlines, I'm in a great mood. That's pretty much all I can say.
Exactly. Yeah, it's nice for Stockport to make the headlines for something like this rather than the usual ways hits the headlines over the years.
Definitely, definitely. Lloyd? Are you feeling Stockport in the area this fine Friday afternoon?
Yeah, despite the fact I'm in southeast London right now, yes, very happy to see Phil getting his flowers. I think very much deserved. We can cover it in a bit more detail, but like George says, it's nice for Stockport to make the headlines, not because it's the most grim town centre in the UK or because of the massive car park that's being erected or something like that. So.
Mate, Stockport, according to a few people that I know, is the new Berlin. So that's all I'm saying. It's already in the middle of its cultural renaissance. So look, obviously, I want to talk about Phil winning the Football Writers Footballer of the Year award. But before that, just really quickly, a word on Tommy Doyle, who his permanent transfer to Wolves for £5 million has been confirmed. So we wish him all the best. Lovely lad, lovely player, top pedigree. Lloyd, you want to have a word?
Yeah, well, I think the best kind of barometer always for these things is just look at the replies to the tweet from the like official Wolves account. It's just inundated with Wolves fans being like, class player, great signing, so chuffed. So, you know, I think that really says it all. They watch him week in, week out. The games I've seen him this season, he's just really tidy. I think that's probably the best way to describe him. They've had some midfield issues, suspensions and injuries this season, like most teams, and he's come into some key games. But yeah, I'm just pleased for him. A bit like Palmer, but it probably stings a bit less. I think he's obviously proven that he's Premier League standard and expecting him to kind of kick on.
I think that's the big thing for me. I always felt that he was a Premier League player. And so the fact that he's got a move to a Premier League club and he's impressed as much as he has impressed and Wolves have ended up finishing where they finished. It's just, yeah, I think it's great for him. It's an incredible bargain at £5 million. Where else are you picking up a Premier League quality young English footballer for £5 million? I mean, it's truly an incredible bargain. George?
Yeah. That last point that you made about the fees, the only part for me that kind of, not stings a bit, but scratching my head slightly at, you know, I can't slate the club for how they've dealt with most of the academy transactions, especially the outgoings. We've got a lot of money for players that have played barely any minutes for the first team. So the club's done a great job there. But like you say, this is a guy who's played all through the England youth levels, very respected in the international sphere. And then he's kind of proven himself as a Premier League quality player this year at Wolves. And then they've got him for £5 million. I mean,
it's 50% sell on for City, though. I think it's got to be said. That's very, very high.
I suppose the sell on is the bit recouping, you know, we can recoup a bit of the money if he does go on to there. But yeah, 5 million seems like Wolves have got an awfully, awfully good deal there. And yeah, I'm just, as with Palmer, I'll be on the lookout for his performances. And I hope he, you know, can really stamp his mark and grab that, you know, starting spot week in, week out for Wolves, because it's another success for the CFA.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, look, I think Wolves had some PSR issues last summer. And so it sounds like City have done them a little bit of a solid by sending him on loan for a year with a very, very, very small fee to make it permanent, but also giving themselves a huge sell-on, which means that if he does You know, if he does do really well, Wolves are the type of club who probably will look to cash in on him at some point. And at that point, I think that would be, that's where City will make their money. But look, I think in the main, I'm just, I'm delighted for him. I think it's a great move for him. Right. It's time to talk about Phil Foden. So obviously he's won the Football Writers Footballer of the Year award. He's got 160 appearances for City, 51 goals. No, that's 150.
Whoa, way more goals than that, I think.
Yeah, no, he's got 160 league appearances, Premier League appearances, and 51 goals. In total, he's got 265 appearances for City already, and he's got 84 goals already. So, Lloyd, this season, he's got 16 league goals, couple in the cups. I think he's got 4 in the Champions League, something like that. 5 in the Champions League. Talk to me about the achievement.
Huge achievement. I think he's the second youngest English player to ever win the Football Writers Award after, I think, Alan Shearer in 1994. So 33 goals and assists across 44 comps this season. I mean, really, he's been the player at key moments where he's won us games, dragged us over the line. It's been his individual quality in tight games that have won us the games. And to be honest, akin to what we've seen down the years from Kev and, you know, before him, Yaya, he's kind of taken the mantle as the key player in the team and been super available. He's played probably almost too many minutes, but that's, you know, to his credit. After having a couple of campaigns where he struggled a bit, I think it sounds like he's started to live a little better, and you can certainly see that in his availability and his performances. And yeah, I mean, he's now our talisman. Pep's been trusting him centrally. There's very little more to say. I'm just very glad that he's kind of received some of the wider acclaim, because obviously as City fans, we all know who the most important players have been this season. But I do like to see it when our players get that kind of award from, you know, writers or fans, etc.
George?
Yeah. I echo all of what Lloyd said there. It's an amazing achievement, and it's really nice to see Foden be kind of recognised outside of the club in a big way. I feel like a lot of the last kind of 5 years has been City fans going, this is the most talented English footballer, and everybody else is going, yeah, all right. And then just focusing on somebody else or the new hot player that week. Whereas, you know, Foden this year, now he's, you know, he's got his record amount of minutes in the Premier League this year. And with that, he's shown what we all knew. As soon as he was playing pretty much week in, week out, he was going to deliver these kind of numbers, deliver these kind of performances. And especially this year, he's put the team on his back in a few games, winning big matches for us. And so to see him recognised for this award, it's amazing, really, especially, like I say, a homegrown player to win this award. And the list of players who've won it, it's, you know, he's in very, very good company there. I think you look through the list, you know, Haaland, Salah's, Sterling's, Diaz, Kante's, Hazard, Suarez, Bale, Van Persie. There's only kind of two outliers for me, Scott Parker and Jordan Henderson, where I'm scratching my head a little bit at those two names.
Hang on. Did Scott Parker win it the year that City won the league for the first time?
No, the year before, he won it 2010-11 season. It was Van Persie who won it the year we won the league.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, you know, outside of those two, it's a really, really fantastic list of Premier League footballers. Pretty much all of them are considered, you know, all-time greats in their own way. So to have Foden on that list, it's a big statement. And, you know, I think it's nice because this is we're still at the start of his trajectory. So I can't wait to see how the next few years unfold for him.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think one of the interesting things will be whether the award is something that leads to a plateau and to complacency, or whether the award is a little bit the motivation he needs to kick on and raise his game to another level. Because I do think that he has another level in him still. I want to take you back to when he first broke into the first team. Obviously, there was a lot of chat around the way that Guardiola had handled him. And I thought Pep in his press conference today, I thought he was quite honest in terms of not trying to take credit for Phil's development and basically going, well, look at Cole Palmer. You know, he's gone to Chelsea and he's killed it. And that's, what I'm interested in is how much of this is about Pep and how much of this is just about Phil.
I do think some of it is to do with Pep, to be fair. I think, you know, on reflection, Pep's handling of Foden in the early years was a touch of absolute genius. Now, at the time, me and you were on this podcast kind of lamenting the fact that he wasn't being played, but there were lots of good reasons for that, you know, not least the fact that look at our squad in like 18, 19 when Phil was breaking through. You know, we used to have like Leroy, Bernardo, Gundo all on the bench, like not even starting. David Silva was still knocking around, like the options were insane. And I think a really good contrast as well is look at Saka at Arsenal. I mean, that guy's going to be done by the age of 28 if Arteta carries on with his handling of him. He's played way too much football and there's been way too much kind of reliance on him from 18, 19, 20. And if you look at Foden's minutes per season across the last 5 to 6 years, it's been a kind of slow and gradual increase.
Mm.
Whereas Saka was almost at 3,000 minutes within his first full year in the first team. That's just not healthy. And, you know, there are lots of good cases, Rooney being one, of how you can really burn a player out. So I do think Pep deserves credit. But, you know, equally, Pep has frustrated me in more recent years with Foden. I think some of his comments going back, you know, even just the beginning of the season, I just found really odd, you know, kind of not bigging up Phil in the press and kind of always talking about some of his kind of misgivings. But you've seen this season that he's absolutely kind of earned Guardiola's faith and trust. And he has been the guy when De Bruyne has been out and the team were kind of struggling, you know, in January, February, who stepped up and has been given that mantle to play the central role that he often hadn't before, because Pep had reservations. And I think that's because he's learned how to kind of bring that other side of the game. So when to slow things down a little bit and then the right time to speed it up, which is what Phil is so good at, kind of in those pockets centrally. So it's really been a coming of age season. And if you look as well at the statistics, Foden has scored so many heavy goals this season, you know, goals that have won City games, big game goals. He's obviously got two hat tricks, you know, Villa and Brentford away. But it's just, there's just so many key games where he stepped up and kind of and done it for City. And it's been, you know, 1-0 goals, 2-1 goals. So, yeah, I think it's been coming of age is probably the best way I would kind of sum it up, really. But I would give Pep some credit for the early kind of developmental stages.
Yeah, I think what I like about Guardiola's handling of Phil is that maybe that sort of like creative tension between Phil's youthful enthusiasm and his style of football, where everything is about forward momentum, and then you've got Guardiola almost begging him to slow everything down all the time. I think that that will make over time Phil a better player, and it'll make him a more rounded player. And so I think that's definitely a positive thing. I guess I do agree with you that I do think that there is an element of Guardiola would never say the things that he says about Phil, about Julian Alvarez, for example. I do find that odd. I think there is a difference, and I don't think it's a Pep thing. All managers do it. They, players who the club pay money for and bring in, particularly from other countries, seem to get a lot more rope and a lot more love than players who come through the academy. But in the main, I think that it's clear that the handling of Phil has been absolutely spot on in terms of minutes, because I agree with you about Saka. Saka looks jaded at times. I think the thing about Foden is that he still looks like the kid that's playing on a playground and could just run forever. And that really is something that I think comes from how they've navigated the amount of minutes they put in his legs. And more, I think as importantly as the minutes that you put in a player's legs is what responsibility do you place on their shoulders? Saka is considered their best player and he's carrying the weight of that team on his shoulders, whether people accept it or not. He's their guy. He's the guy. And as good as Phil has been this season, Kevin De Bruyne is still considered our most important player. Rodri is still considered our second most important player. There is so much quality and experience around Foden that you don't feel that he carries the weight of responsibility that maybe Saka has to carry at Arsenal. George, where does Phil sit in the top 10 players in the world right now?
Well, this is an interesting one. I think for a lot of City fans, even when they remove the bias because of the amount of, you know, football we've seen him play compared to, you know, fans of other clubs, I think a lot would put him edging that in the top 10, I think, at this point. I know it's a bold claim maybe because then you start to think, well, how many other City players do make up the top 10? And for me, it's probably Rodri, KDB, Haaland, and Foden, I would put in right at the bottom of the list. I know there's a lot of talented footballers out there and probably fans from other European leagues especially would might, you know, laugh at those, at me putting four City players in, but I think when you've gone off the back of a treble winning season and you've seen the performances Phil was putting in even when he wasn't, you know, in the starting 11 then, and then this season when he's been given kind of a bit more creative freedom in the middle, bit more of a team role, I think, you know, I can't think of many players that have performed better than him this season consistently in big games and in big moments.
Lloyd, you going to put him in the world's top five?
I think so. who's there instead of him?
Oh, look, I think that if you want to talk about the three best players in the world right now, then you're talking about Mbappe, Haaland and Foden, and then you can make your mind up about what order you want to put them in. But they, along with Kevin De Bruyne, those four are the best four footballers in the world right now. So for me, obviously, being from Stockport, I'd have Phil at number one, but I'm all right with somebody else going, nah, Kev's number one. I struggle. I see a lot of people saying that Mbappe's best footballer in the world right now. I'm just not having that. I don't see what other people see in him.
I rate Mbappe and I would put him in the top 10, but I think I would never claim he's the best in the world because, you know, we've seen it. He was great. He's been great for France, but I think at club level, I think we need to see a little more from him in the big moments. And I think maybe that will only materialise if he does make the move to Real Madrid in the summer and is playing in a tougher league and maybe tougher Champions League fixtures. But I do rate Mbappe and I would put him up there. But I would put Foden in the top 10 at the moment, at this moment in time.
Top five, mate.
There's no clear number one at the moment, is there? Which I think is actually a good thing for football as a whole. I think Phil's in the top. I'd say he's in the top five. You know, you've got, who are the main guys in the conversation? I think the ones you've outlined, I'd probably say Vinicius is in and around there. Rodri's definitely in the conversation. I would not have Bellingham in the conversation yet, like a lot of people seem to. I think he's currently the bookies' favourite for the Ballon d'Or, which seems a bit mental. But yeah, I'm struggling to think of many players that would not fill out the top five. So he's top five for me.
Yeah, I don't see a world in which he's not in the top five footballers in the world right now. I think the impact that he's had on the team this season, the goal involvement, excuse me. I think that he's without question one of the top five in the world. Right. One last question before I move on from Phil. It's just kind of popped in my head, so I thought I'd ask the two of you. Future City captain?
I don't think so. I don't think it's his character, really. Mm. And I think for example, there's an interview of like the players the other day. I think it was Bernardo and Kev, and they were asked about who would you have as like a joker in the dressing room, and they go, to be honest, any of the English lads, Kyle, Stonesy, but not Phil. He's a bit quiet and boring. I don't think Phil's got that personality to be a captain. I think he's more of a quiet, unassuming guy. Maybe by the time he's like 28, pushing 30, that might kind of come out of him a bit. But yeah, I think he's probably just a key player rather than a captain for me.
Okay. George?
Yeah, I don't see a future where he's the captain. I think you see maybe in the past with a lot of clubs, who maybe aren't always competing at the very top, they tend to make maybe their best player their captain. Whereas I think when you're a team like City, when you have as many good players as, you know, we're privileged to do at the moment, I think, you know, there's different roles, and I think the captain role, you know, needs to be a bit more of a, you know, a chest pumping motivator, a bit more aggressive. And I think, you know, we've got the captaincy structure in place at the moment. I don't see a world where Rodri leaves City in the next few years, and he's my probably bet for the next City captain. I think once he is, I don't think anybody else will be captain for quite a few years, because I think he'll hang on to that for a while.
Yep. And then last question on Phil, will he start for England at the Euros this summer?
If Southgate's got even half a brain cell, he should. But I also wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't. But I'm going to say he is going to start, actually, but it will be Southgate's going to stick him out on the left wing.
Lloyd?
Yeah, he's going to start, but he's going to be shunted out on the left wing.
Yeah, I expect that's what will end up happening, much to my chagrin. Anyway, so hey, I'm going to take you on a little bit of a detour before we talk about Klopp's comments about English team's relative failure in Europe and the scheduling in England, just very briefly. So there's this story during the rounds about a Premier League game potentially being played in the US in future. And I'm interested in both, before I give my opinion, I'm interested in both of your opinions on this. Lloyd, what's your take on this?
I was hoping you wouldn't ask about this. Yeah, I mean, I've got a pretty strong opinion on this. I'm kind of vehemently against it. No one has put forward for me a good kind of argument of why it should be. Kind of what Sam, the American citizen, says about, you know, growing the game in the US. Respectfully, fuck growing the game in the US. You know, City play in Manchester. There are teams in the US. There's a full league over there. It's very different to me to the NFL, which is often the example that's thrown back at us. I think my problem is that it's probably going to happen because it's a massive cash grabbing exercise, and it would obviously do incredibly well. But from a practical perspective, I just cannot see how it makes sense. You know, so what happens if we had to play, say, Liverpool away? We had to play our home game against Liverpool over in the States, but they got their game at Anfield. I mean, it's just a total mess. But I think the reality is that it probably will happen. I think it would make more sense to kind of broaden out the pre-season schedule over there, or play like a Carabao Cup final over there, or create a new game that goes over there. I think that all those kind of things make more sense than probably creating a new game or kind of tournament which was mooted before COVID would probably be the best solution. But yeah, I don't want to go into too much detail, but I absolutely hate the idea.
George?
I'm also yeah, 100% against the idea of playing competitive Premier League fixtures overseas. I think, as Lloyd says, a lot of people say, you know, when English and British fans complain about that idea, they say, oh, well, the NFL comes to London, it goes to Mexico. And it does, but NFL teams are franchises and not clubs that have been, you know, in communities for hundreds of years. A lot of these franchises are relatively new. Some have moved from city to city. And even the more, and then the most historic franchises in the NFL, such as like the Green Bay Packers, they refuse to go over and lose one of their home games. So they've said they'll only go over if they're playing what would be one of their away games. So you can see even with the more historic side of the NFL, American football there, they don't want to play overseas. It's just, like you say, a cash grabbing and marketing exercise. I think there's other vehicles where you can grow the game in the US. I think the World Cup in 2026 is going to be brilliant across USA, Canada and Mexico. Obviously, Mexico's a massive football country, but USA and Canada, I think that this World Cup will be amazing for growing the game over there. I think the things like the expanded Club World Cup should be used over there. And as Lloyd says, the pre-season is a great thing because, yeah, you can't play any of the big Premier League clashes overseas because one team will be calling for unfair advantage if they lose the home game, as Lloyd says. So you'd be playing early kind of August fixtures, which obviously there's stuff on the line, but there's not much on the line. You can recover from losing your first or second game in the league. And so it basically would teams treat it as like the pre-season, and therefore the competitive edge would be gone. So yeah, I think it's messy, incredibly messy. And I really, really do hope that the Premier League doesn't go ahead with it. But again, I wouldn't be surprised in 10, 15 years if it does.
I mean, look, I'm not really, rather than giving what I think is my opinion, I think there's a reality that a little bit we have to face up to, which is that football at the top end is a global entertainment business. And so the idea that the global markets that pay loads of money for the product may one day say, hey, we'd like the product to come to us. It's not a shock for me. I'm quite surprised at the kind of visceral reactions from people. The number of people saying things like, you know, oh, well, that'd be it for me in football. It's just a bit like, it's going to happen, you know, like eventually, like in 3 years or in 5 years, it's going to happen. I think that the part of the big stadiums, the best players, the best managers, the best facilities, like all of that is paid for by the TV rights. And those TV rights, the global TV rights, are what make the Premier League what the Premier League is. And so I think we have to be a little bit cognizant of that balance. Now, for me, just from a practical point of view, like you said, Lloyd, I mean, how on earth are you going to decide which game gets played overseas? Because somebody's getting a disadvantage.
It's a farce.
So I don't see a world in which that's really happening. But when you begin to talk about the FA Cup and the Carabao Cup, like Champions League final, like games like that, I absolutely 100% can see a world in which those types of one-off games, they do start shipping them around the world to please the overseas stakeholders. Because I think it's a reality of the modern game at the top. And we shouldn't forget the Super League was only a couple of years ago. Do you know what I mean? And that was about changing the entire fabric of the game at the very top. Forget about we're going to go and play like games overseas. That was like, yeah, we're starting a new league with only three other teams from our country and eight other teams from eight other countries. And it's just like, you know, there is a the kind of football isn't immune from hyper-capitalism. And so what you're seeing is a knock-on effect of that. And it's just, I don't see a world in which it goes away. Unfortunately, I think we sort of have to make our peace with it.
Yeah.
Couple of things just to say on that though, because I think you're right to reference the Super League. For me, this actual whole debate a little bit exposes the lack of actual work that's been done by rulemakers in the midst of the Super League. So it's something that, you know, I was kind of very vocal on when this happened a few years ago. The government should be legislating, in my view, to create a sort of kind of legislative wrapper to kind of embed the football teams in the communities that they are so that they cannot be ripped up and taken abroad. Now, this hasn't happened mainly because, well, a bit like the water industry in the UK, kind of politics at the moment is kind of bathing in its own shite, and, you know, very little has been done, you know, to much more kind of important real life issues than this kind of thing. That being said, it's still something I feel strongly on. I think, like you say, a final or, you know, something where there isn't a kind of reverse fixture.
Totally.
I think it does make a bit more sense. But even still, Kieran Maguire did a really good tweet in response to, I think it was Adam Crafton. You know, I'd like to see the same energy from people pushing it to be in the US when this inevitably goes to the Far East, you know, the Gulf, fucking North Korea. Like, do you know what I mean? I don't think there'll be the same energy then. So there we go.
Yeah, no, I mean, I saw Kieran's reply to Adam Crafton, and it's his reply was also problematic in that, well, we've already had a World Cup in the Middle East, and we're going to have another World Cup in the Middle East. And I think that the kind of weird Western view on, oh, Middle East bad, dirty, USA great, that's bad, and the football press indulge in it as much as anybody else indulges in it. And Kieran's reply a little bit exposes that idea that, you know, we have allowed ourselves to, and when I say ourselves, I mean the kind of general footballing landscape, it's allowed itself to paint the Middle East in a very particular light with regards to football, which is incredibly negative from top to bottom. And yet we don't reserve that same energy for the US, and that's problematic in its own way. No,
that's exactly my point though. You know, why is it more important to grow the game in the US than it is somewhere else in the world? But that's
there's a lot of American owners in the Premier League, that's why.
Yeah, and there's a lot of American fans, but I don't like some of the energy around that, to be honest. I'm with you. I think it, you know, there's loads of xenophobia kind of wrapped up within this. So
yeah, I mean, I try and avoid getting too upset about these things, because I do think that there's an underlying reality to the product and what the product is. The deal is that apparently for the Premier League to take games overseas, if a regulator comes in, the government regulator would have to approve it. But then, do you have faith in the regulator to say no? How much political kind of pressure would end up being put on them to allow something like that to go through? So it's just, you know, it's the way of the world, man. It's just all about money and bottom lines and super wealthy people wanting to make more money. And make no mistake, whether it's Mansour or it's the fellas at FSG or it's the fellas that own Arsenal or it's the fellas that own Villa or it's the fellas that run Atletico Madrid, all these fellas just want to make as much money as they can. Very few of them give one shiny shit about a local supporter. And that applies also to the broadcasters and everybody who drinks from the football money trough. All of those people don't give a shit about us. The only thing they give a shit about is making more money. Sorry, George, you were going to say something.
No, yeah, it's just a point on the kind of the quality of the product as well. I think why there is football does have a global audience, and the Premier League has now a global audience, is when they're watching it, the spectacle in the stadiums, the passion, all that kind of stuff is part of it. It's part of what makes it great. You know, the scenes inside City Stadium, you know, for the Madrid semi-final last year, or when we, you know, beat Villa, QPR, so many, you know, famous days and nights. You wouldn't get that overseas. It would be like a more friendly atmosphere. It wouldn't be the people, you know, the same kind of passion on display. There'd still be, you know, fans of the clubs turning up, but I think it would be different, and therefore the quality of the product might not actually be as good overseas, and would it just all feel like a friendly? That's what it would be, one of my concerns as well. Like the fans, the global fans might be disappointed with the quality of what they get when it's taken overseas. Would it be the same as over here? I'm not too sure.
Well, it can't be the same, can it? Because ultimately, like,
where's the local rivalry between?
Yeah, exactly.
Fans,
it's just it's a novelty thing, isn't it? Then it becomes like in my head, then it kind of becomes like German football, in the sense that it's just like loads of people doing loads of choreographed stuff that is completely disconnected from what's actually happening on the pitch.
There's nothing instinctual or off the cuff.
Yeah, exactly.
It's all very predictable, rehearsed, and you say a bit sterilised. But no, I agree with, you know, Björn Lloyd's points about, you know, the British media's view on American interest in football, as opposed to the Far East and the Middle East. It's you know, the hypocrisy on show is startling, because from my experience of, you know, growing up, you know, it in the football, you know, mattered to football from such a young age, and, you know, liking to think I know a fair amount about it. You know, the interest from the Middle East and the Far East is they want a seat at the table, whereas I think America want to own the whole table and control it for their own endeavours. So I'm actually always more wary of American investment than I would be from investment from other parts of the world.
Very well said. Very well said. My own experience, I can only say, is that, you know, having been at Pakistan and kind of the lived on that side of the world, like the passion for the Premier League. It's just, I always find it funny when we talk about a place as one particular thing. Like with the Middle East, we've decided that it is one particular thing, or the media have, and they speak about it in a certain way, and they forget that, you know, it's full of tens of millions of kids and adults alike that are just obsessed with footy, and that's all right. Do you know what I mean? I think that if tens of millions of people in the US are just obsessed with footy, right, and we want to try and serve the products to them in the best way possible and all that business, well, the same applies everywhere else.
Yeah, definitely. When I was in India in February, March time, you know, the amount of people that I was, you know, chatting to about football and their interest and knowledge, it was, you know, I was quite blown away, to be honest. And, you know, the times they get up to watch the matches, and it's crazy. They are so invested, and yet you never hear of a match that's going to be played in Mumbai or Delhi. That's never spoken about, but it's constantly about America and Canada, and it's interesting.
Right. Before we chat the title race and the Wolves game, here's a little interlude with Mr. Howard Hocking talking to Dan from Wolves Fancast.
I'm delighted to be joined by Dan from the Wolves Fancast. Good afternoon, Dan. How are you?
Oh yeah, Howard. How are things with you? Tense, excited, optimistic, pessimistic?
Well,
all of the above.
You won't know this, but it's the last day of my 40s today.
Wow. So
I've got a birthday due tonight, and I don't like being the centre of attention. So I've got that to be anxious about before I even think about the football tomorrow, which is on my birthday. So all in all, yes, very anxious and nervous. So how about you? How are you doing?
I'm all good. We've had a good season. Petered out a little bit in the last sort of couple of months due to injuries, fatigue, bit of an FA Cup disappointment, but I'm sure we'll discuss that a bit more.
Yeah. Well, you're 11th as the season draws to end. The season as a whole, then, as you just alluded to, does it feel like it's been split in half, in a way, in that the first half was better than the second half?
Yeah, most definitely. I think I'm not putting words into your mouth, but I think a lot of Premier League content creators, pundits, predicted Wolves to be in a serious relegation battle at the start of the season. Days before the season, Julian Lopetegui left. Gary O'Neill came in on the back of being sacked by Bournemouth on paper. I'm not sure there was many Wolves fans that was optimistic going into the season, but coming out the back of January, February, battered our local rivals in the FA Cup at their place, doing well in the league, done the double over Tottenham, done the double over Chelsea, beat yourselves at Molineux. Yeah, things were really optimistic, and then sort of injuries to Pedro Neto, Hwang Ki-chan came back from the Asia Cup, just completely obliterated. Jurgen Klinsmann's been in the media recently, being sort of, besmirched by the South Korean media for how he ran the players into the ground during the tournament. And if you look at sort of Heung-min Son, he hasn't really kicked on since coming back from that same tournament. We lost our other forward, Jean-Rick Nabelgaard, in that same period. So in the games where we were, like the Coventry FA Cup quarterfinal, for instance, we had a 19-year-old striker starting up front, and he was replaced by an 18-year-old striker. So we literally had little to no attacking options going into probably the biggest game of the season in Gary O'Neill's managerial career. It's a bit of a sour taste, really, because we were on the cusp of doing something quite special this season, but falling a bit short in the end.
I don't want to revisit that FA Cup, but you must have been dreaming of Wembley. It must have been gutting for that, especially the nature of that game.
Yeah, I think everyone going into the, you know, we managed to get past Brighton in the previous round, which was as much as they've struggled recently. Brighton are still a good side in the Premier League. They've had they've been depleted by injuries heavily as well, but getting past Brighton, then you see you've got Coventry, the lowest ranked team left in the tournament at home in the quarterfinal. You know, I'm sure there would have been a lot of Wolves fans who were booking free cancellation hotels for that weekend, and I wasn't one of them. I'm ingrained with Wolves letting me down when I least expect it. So yeah, it's disappointing. But like I said, on paper we were looking at a relegation battle. So if someone would have said to me at the start of the season we'd be in and around top half, you get to an FA Cup quarterfinal and you battle your local rivals away in the FA Cup, I would have bit my hands off for that.
Yeah, even when we got Burton in the semi-final of the Carabao Cup, they were 19-1 to get through. So we booked for Wembley, a few of us, but we also put a fiver on Burton to go through as the insurance. So if they did go through, it'd pay for the train and the hotel that we no longer needed.
That's bonkers that you just said that, Howard. You said Burton was 19-1. I looked at the odds for Wolves to win tomorrow and it was 22-1 when I last looked.
Wow. Well, we'll get to that because historically, I don't know how big a role history plays, but I'm surprised it'd be that long odds, to be honest. So Gary O'Neill himself done a good job as far as Wolves fans are concerned. Has he maintained the previous playing style as well, or has he changed things around?
He's pretty much improved the previous playing style. I think if you look back to sort of under Nuno and Lopetegui to a degree, it was a sort of a flat back five and counter-attacking, but he's sort of taken upon what Pep's done in regards to sort of inverting fullbacks and playing some like massively weird hybrid roles to the bog standard 4-4-2 English supporting football fan. But now we're really nice on the eye at times now. I think I mentioned earlier the attacking players, Pedro Neto, Matheus Cunha and Hwang Ki-chan, they've been exceptional going forward this year. I think Pedro Neto was top of the assist charts come, I think, maybe the end of December period. And he was injured for about 6 or 7 weeks of that start of the season. So, yeah, he'll be one of the players that's likely to be touted for a move in the summer. But yeah, Gary O'Neill's done wonders. I think it was a bit of an underwhelming appointment. He said so himself. Yeah. If Gary O'Neill said if he was a Wolves fan, he would have found Gary O'Neill underwhelming. But he's really built a bond with the fans now. I think like the fans and the players have built into his philosophy. There's you know, that cliche about players being on the beach. There hasn't been an essence of that from me from this group of players going into these last few games when they easily could be?
You've answered one of my later questions. I kind of hate that term. Maybe on the last day of the season, some are dreaming of that beach or the summer, but you've not seen that. I mean, that's not the reason that you're not picking up a lot of results recently, is it? That, do you see the application is the same as it has been all season? And you expect that this weekend too?
I think he sort of, we started the season, I think we went away to Manchester United on the opening game of the season. I think everyone was aware we were done over by VAR when Andre Onana did his classic, just punching players in the face, swimming for crosses.
He's not allowed to now, yeah.
Well, he's been finally found out, hasn't he? There's like a bit of a... Edward Word, it sort of like a narrative, isn't there, that there's a top six bias in regards to VAR, but Burnley got a decision away at Old Trafford, and you know, years gone by without VAR, would a referee have given that to Burnley? It's hopefully things are turning. Man United aren't a big six side, are they, in league standings anymore? Yeah. They might have that sort of revenue, but they're struggling, aren't they? It's good to see.
But do you feel as Wolves fan that VAR's gone? And officiating's gone against you this season?
I mean, there's probably close to 10 decisions that have gone against us this season.
I remember tons in the first half of the season. Has it continued, or was it mostly stacked early doors?
It was heavily stacked early doors. I think we had about a period from January to... I think someone did make a joke that we'd gone some... I think it was December the 30th to sometime in March without a VAR decision going against them. Then we had two in a row. It's been frustrating. VAR was supposed to be brought in to stop howlers, but them just making that much of a hash of it at the moment, re-refereeing games over the smallest of incidents. It's really frustrating, because the concept of VAR could be a really good thing, but like I said, unless we're going to start importing the officials that I'm doing a good job of it abroad, we're so far down the rabbit hole with it now, I'm not sure we can get out.
No. It's weird. I just found a VAR joke I made on Twitter in 2019. I hadn't realised we'd had it that long, but nothing's changed. This is what I commented about. Nothing has changed. It's not there to bring consistency. And I think that's what we were sold. We were sold VAR on it bringing consistency and correcting errors. But it's not really, is it? It's there for clear and obvious. So you're getting consistency still. So
yeah, that's the problem, isn't it? Clear and obvious, it should be the concept of what's followed. But the referees are finding, referees are finding that many little incidents now to that the average referee linesman wouldn't be spotting without 40 different camera angles. So how can it be clear and obvious? You know, like how you see on like Monday Night Football when they sort of go into like 2D graphics from like the referee's angle.
Yeah.
That's what they should be using for VAR.
Yeah.
If the referee can't see it, then it's not clear and obvious, is it?
No, well, yeah, I don't know. They'll keep tinkering with it and nothing will probably improve that much. Semi-automatic offside will help speed stuff up maybe, but I don't think anyone's going to be any happier two years down the line, let's be honest. We're just going to have to suck it up, aren't we? Couple of players with City links. First off, the player that's at Wolves and will be staying there today, Tommy Doyle. Permanent deal to Wolves has been confirmed. How do you feel about that? How good has he been for you?
He's been really solid in the appearances that he's made. He took a little bit of a while to sort of break into the starting 11 because of the just the ever consistent ability and efforts that Mario Lemina and João Gomes have been laying out this season. But when he has come in, he's done really well. It was a no-brainer, the transfer value that was being reported when we took him on loan.
Yeah.
I believe there's a 50% sell-on fee, which is in the deal reported today. So it could be here for 4 or 5 years. It could be a bonkers situation where he gets sold in the summer for double profit than what we paid for him, because he is that sort of he has proved his Premier League calibre. So be interesting to see. Obviously, he's got the reputation, the calibre of playing for the England under-21s. I think winning that tournament at the start of this season. So yeah, he's definitely, you can tell he's come through the City Academy really tidy on the ball, got a good vision, good awareness, and he's only going to get better with more and more appearances that he picks up.
I assume he can't play. He's still on loan. You know, the deal is permanent in the summer, so he can't play on Saturday. I assume he would have started if he wasn't a loan player.
Yeah, there's a possibility with Gary O'Neill's been tinkering with players in different roles. I think Tommy Doyle played left wing about a week or so ago because, like I said, we were that depleted with forward options. Mario Lemina has played there. It's been a bit of a bonkers few months really with our forward options because Gary O'Neill's tried everything, and to a degree we've picked up some results against the odds. I think we managed to beat Brighton in the FA Cup at home. We beat Fulham at home a few days later when we really shouldn't have beaten those sides with the players that we had out injured. But yeah, he would have been pushing. And I think the biggest stat, which he might have had an impact on if he was available, is Wolves are still the only side in the Premier League this season that haven't scored a goal from outside the box.
Wow. But he can score from that distance, can't he?
He's got the ability. He scored an absolute cracker with his left foot against Brentford in the third round at their stadium at the start of the season. So yeah, he's definitely got it in his locker.
Now, on the flip side, does it surprise you that Nunes has not been a roaring success at City?
I wouldn't say it's a surprise just because of the players that he's probably got ahead of him in the pecking order. He's definitely got ability. I was disappointed to see him go, but I never really envisaged him being here. Coming to Wolves in the first place. I think he has got European ability, so.
So you think he can turn it around at City?
I'd be interested to see what your opinion is on that, because I said the players that City have got in the pecking order ahead of him, I'm not sure he's ever going to be able to get into a run of games to really show what he's about. It's tough, isn't it, coming on for fleeting cameos in cup games, and I'm not really sure he's really excelled in the European games that he's featured in either.
It's more the skill set he's got. There's plenty of games for, you know, it's a squad game after all. He could have got, you know, if he'd impressed Pep more, a lot more time on the pitch, but he clearly isn't taking on board what Pep wants. And that, you know, there is this theory that for a lot of players, it's second season until they, you know, like Grealish, who truly understand what Pep wants. But I just wonder if his skill set is needed by City as a ball carrier, and I'm not sure what else he is. Obviously, he's quite talented on the ball, but I don't see a lot else in his. I don't see an all-round skill set that see him moving on at the moment. But who knows? I don't know.
It's,
that makes sense to you. Yeah,
yeah, definitely. His ball carrying ability is one of his best attributes. That you look back to sort of the Wolves, Man United game I mentioned earlier, start of the season. Him, Mateus Cunha, and Pedro Neto, that opening game, were cutting through Man United like butter with their ball carrying ability. But I'm not sure what sort of level his sort of passing range is to be a regular starter for City. And for the money that City paid for him, you would have expected him to have done a lot more this season for the Blues.
Right, to Saturday's game. Are you a big fan of the 5:30 kickoff?
I am. I'm very much a big fan of it. I think there's I'm not sure what the negatives are really, unless like you're travelling a fair distance. But for me, I'm always a fan of matches under the lights, a lot more drinking time to be partaking in. I think just atmospheres in the evenings are a lot better. I'm really, really. I mean, I hate to sound like a Jurgen Klopp, the bratwurst. But 12:30 kickoffs are the worst for me.
Oh, the crap. Yeah, I mean, just terrible.
Our atmosphere is at Molineux. I'm not sure the last time we won an early kickoff. I mean, we played Coventry in the FA Cup, and that was an early kickoff. And our atmosphere at 12:00 kickoffs, they're atrocious.
Yeah, agreed. Fortunately, they're here to stay. The 12:30s, aren't they? But I don't know. I just don't think the players are tuned in to playing at that time either. So the later the better, basically. Well, not 8 o'clock. It just seems weird on a Saturday night that those are crept in. But 5:30 is great for pubs, just to work it around pubs. So 3 o'clock's absolutely fine as well in that respect. What the injury situation? Are you still really sure, or are things a bit better? You know, because you've alluded to it during our chat so far. Are things looking up? Are you still short up front, or how's it looking injury wise?
Bit by bit, players are starting to return. Wangi Chan and Matheus Cunha both started the last game at home to Luton, but they're still sort of building up minutes. So I think Wang was able to play the full 90 maybe last week, but whether they can go again this week. I mean, obviously they've had a good week to sort of build up a little bit more fitness at the training ground, so I expect both of them to start tomorrow. Pedro Neto is back running on the grass for Wolves, but I'm not sure he's actually partaking in contact training yet, so he'll be missing again tomorrow. Apart from that, Craig Dawson's the only really main name player that won't be featuring again this season after going through groin surgery.
So I said already, I'm surprised at the odds. Obviously, City don't lose many at home, hence the odds, really. But history suggests this season and beyond that you can pose many problems. You optimistic about this game? And how do you think O'Neill will set up? How he sets up because of City?
Yeah, it'll be pretty much like how we've done previously. I imagine it's going to be sort of a backfire. I think losing Craig Dawson's a big blow. If you look back to the previous game, Craig Dawson did an absolute number on Erling Haaland that Saturday afternoon. It's looking like Mac Doherty may be the third centre-half in our back three, back five, however way you look at it, because Santiago Breno, where we signed from Girona in the summers, picked up a hamstring injury as well. So we really are fighting against the odds with regards to squad availability at the moment. But even if we had a full fit side, the fact that Man City haven't got Champions League, they haven't had a midweek game to contend with, going for the title in good run of form, it's going to be a tough game tomorrow. And I'm literally looking on a reputable betting website at this second. The Wolves are now 25-1.
Going to put a couple of quid on?
I never bet on my side to win. I just hate to jinx my side in any form or fashion. I even hate having Wolves players in my fantasy Premier League side because I just don't like to jinx them in any way.
No. Oh, yeah, I've been stuck in them with United players for years and it's worked out quite well. But no, I never bet on a City game either. I'm just not interested in that side. Like accumulating at the weekend, but I leave City out of it all the time. So unless it's a friendly, there's nothing riding on it. So key players for Wolves right now then, if you can do City damage, is it going to be low block and counter-attacking? That's how you get at City most.
I'd like to find a coach out there who's found a way to contend against City that doesn't involve a low block, because you need sort of either aliens or a football side full of illegal inhalers to get one over Man City.
Who could you be thinking of?
That's up to you. I'm just putting my thoughts out there. There's no sort of identification or tagging to any sides out there in that statement I just made. The main players for Wolves tomorrow, Ryan Aitnori, who's been linked to Man City recently.
Yeah.
He's one of the sort of inverted fullbacks that I mentioned earlier. A lot of our build-up play comes through him. He's got serious ball-carrying ability. And he's really good on the eyes, got a lot of flair, can create stuff out of nothing. I can't think...
Almost got in our team of the season. We did a podcast earlier and he just got edged out, I think. But yeah, he was in the discussions in our team of the season.
Yeah,
Premier League team of the season, yeah.
He's been outstanding. There isn't many left-backs in world football for me that have been playing to his ability levels this season. He's definitely, I mean, he's still only young. He's definitely got a good future ahead of him. I think PSG have also been linked to him as well. So it'd be interesting to see where his career ends up, because he's one of the players for me that Wolves need to be building a squad round in the next couple of years. But I think the ability that he's got, he'll be poached sooner rather than later, as well as João Gomes in our centre midfield. He joined for a reported fee of £12 million last January before under Lopetegui, and he grows better and better with each game. Absolutely relentless. Doesn't like giving the ball up. When he gives it away, he's tenacious in getting it back. So he'll be key again on Saturday. I think him and Mario Lemina coming up against Roger will be a big battle. And I've already mentioned him, Matheus Cunha. If he starts for Wolves, he's key to us getting any victory, because a lot of our play goes for him. And even though he's still not the stereotypical number nine that we're still craving, he's really important to the way that Gary O'Neill's Wolves like to play.
Okay, we're going to finish off with a couple of things away from City and Wolves. So go with your head or your heart, a score prediction. I think on Premier League show I went for 3-1. So we've always got a goal conceded in us, to be honest.
It's a shame that I'm going to have to share this episode when it goes out on our social media, but I've been saying all week it's going to be like 4-0 City. I mentioned it a few moments ago that City are a juggernaut when it comes to this, the business end of the season. You've not had a midweek game to contend with. As much as we've got players coming back from injury, I just feel like it's going to be too big of a task tomorrow. I've mentioned Craig Dawson's not playing. Max Kilman, as good as he is, he's not as solid without Craig Dawson next to him. And I'm fearing it's going to be a bit of an onslaught on Sky Sports tomorrow night. But if I'm going to be really optimistic from a Wolves fan point of view, it would be classic Wolves to beat City tomorrow, wouldn't it? We've got a good record against you since we got promoted overall. Yeah.
No Traore around though, is there?
No Traore. I think Pedro Neto caused you a lot of problems in the Molineux fixture earlier on this season. He's missing as well tomorrow, so it's going to be tough. But I'm not sure, has anyone else in the league done the double over you this season?
No, but Brentford did last season.
Yeah, so there is that, always that odd bit of a stat every season, isn't it, that crops up?
Now the second Brentford game was dead rubber at the end of the season, so it didn't really matter. But they did us, of course, in the very last game before the World Cup at the Etihad, so it is, of course, possible. Look, just finally, in dispatches, you noted to me wanting City to persevere over Arsenal in the league. Now, I assumed you were just being nice, because what people say when I chat to opposition fans, yeah, they're always great and nice about City. What they say elsewhere may be different, and I have no problem with that, by the way. I don't think City should be everyone's favourite other team. But you did seem to have a bit of beef with Arsenal. Is it fair to say that? Do you really want City to overcome Arsenal in the league?
Most definitely. I'm one of these people that Man City are the best of all evils when it comes to that top three. Wait, it's top two. It's top two race now, isn't it?
We are all evil, let's be honest.
Yeah, the Liverpool Reds have fallen away, unfortunately for them. We'll be going to Anfield again on the last game of the season to sarcastically chant our way through the game against them. It's sad to see that Jurgen Klopp farewell tour hasn't gone to his desires. But yeah, let's get back to my disdain for Arsenal. It goes back to the 2020-21 season. So the season before, we finished above Arsenal in the league. Not many people remember this. We finished seventh, they finished eighth. The season after, we were going for I think it was the sort of the Champions League places with Arsenal, Tottenham and West Ham. And in the February, we got beat by Arsenal twice in a month, and neither game Wolves deserved to lose. But I was having conversations with sort of Arsenal fan friends of mine, and I was saying during that period of time, we were league rivals. Forget about history and whatnot. We were rivals, and like their attitude was we were never rivals, we'll never be rivals. Yeah. But if we finished above you in the league and we're going for the same sort of competition places, we're rivals. And they're just a really toxic fan base. I think they're probably the worst on social media for arrogance and just toxicity. I mean, they're even toxic to their own players. What they did to Declan Rice's partner a few weeks ago was borderline disgraceful.
I don't know who it is. It's just them alone. Others. It's one of the weirdest, most creepy things I've seen.
Yeah,
the internet for you. Instance.
Yeah, their number two goalkeeper, Aaron Ramsdale, is a boiled West Bromwich Albion fan. So I've just got no time for him whatsoever.
That was the last final straw for you.
That was the final straw, yeah. There used to be going back to the sort of early 2000s when they had Henry, Pires, Bergkamp, there was a really good footballing side to watch. Yeah. But since then, they haven't won a league since the Invincibles. And yet, from the way their fans behave on social media, you'd think they were entitled to the title race every season. And for me, the amount of money that Mikel Arteta spent, there should be in a title race. But like I've said, I want City to go all the way. And if I'm literally a minority that wanted Liverpool to win the league over Arsenal, that's how much Arsenal have grated me over the last handful of years. It's shocking that I'm saying it. I wouldn't have wanted to go to Anfield on the last game of the season, seeing Liverpool win the title.
Mm.
Definitely. But Liverpool over Arsenal would have been my choice, and that's my disdain for Arsenal in a nutshell, really.
Apologies for triggering you there, but constantly good therapy, that.
If I wasn't already bald, I would have been pulling my hair out then.
Right, it's good to hear anyway. Just finally, I'm going to share a link that you'd be putting out later. Do you just want to spend a minute to say what it's about? A good cause that you're involved in.
Yeah, so Friday the 24th of May, we're playing in a charity football match at Molyneux Stadium on behalf of the Mental Health Charity Mine. This is the second year in a row that we've done it. We raised £3,500 for them last year, so hopefully we can break that fee again. So basically, Wolves Fancast, along with other Wolves social media channels, are teaming up against other Premier League content creators on the Friday. Wolves social media.
Can you take
channels.
Goldbridge out for me, please?
We sent the invite out, but he's just too busy, isn't he, with his green screening for Talk Sports and everything else.
I don't think he can leave his home. Yeah.
So. No, that's exactly. Yeah. We'll have to try and get someone from Man City involved next year.
Mm. My knees went a long time ago. Sorry.
I'll just quickly run the Just Giving link. So it's www.justgiving.com/page/WolvesFancastCCC24.
Brilliant. So, well, I say it sounds like it clearly is a wonderful cause. And those that listen to our Premier League show today will have heard about a similar thing. So important. So if you are listening and you're a City fan, check our Twitter feed today, because we'll have more details about that later in the day. So, Dan, could talk for a lot longer, but time has to feed us. Thank you very much for coming on and talking about Wolves.
Yeah, good luck for the rest of the season. I'm really sorry if we'll scupper your title odds tomorrow, but what did Riyad Mahrez say? It's just the game, innit?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. I've been quite zen because of obviously winning the treble last season, then I can't really complain about anything, but this time of the season does get me super anxious. So anyway, yeah, thanks for going on. And always, after this weekend, all the best with the rest of the season. And we'll go back to the panel now to preview the weekend game.
And we're back in the room. Right, time to talk about squeaky bum time in the title race. I want to start with... I heard a stat the other day that kind of blew my mind a little bit. So Arsenal play Bournemouth tomorrow. It is tomorrow, that game, isn't it?
12:30 early kickoff.
Lovely. So Arsenal play Bournemouth tomorrow. Now, if the league had started after the first 9 games, Bournemouth would be currently be sitting in 5th. So, Lloyd, how good a job has Iraola done there?
Yeah, incredible. Really, he was quite close to getting, maybe not the sack, but
yep.
There was a lot of chat around, you know, if they don't get a couple of results, I think it was round about kind of, October, November time, he could have been gone. He's completely turned them around. Now, I think Bournemouth have got the 16th biggest budget in the league, so... Yeah, that tells its own story. It's been some really good recruitment over the last 12 months from them. But to be kind of hitting around the cities, Liverpools, Arsenals, Villas of this world from this season, I mean, that's incredible when you consider you've got Spurs, you've got Newcastle, you've got United, you've got Chelsea. I mean, all four of those are like incredibly well funded, you know, some well run, some not well run clubs. So I'm a bit surprised actually that there's not been more chat of Iraola maybe kind of taking the step up from one of the Premier League teams that are looking for new managers. I would include United in that. I'm a little surprised that, there hasn't been more noise. So he's done an incredible job. And I have actually looked at this game for a while thinking, I think for me, this is probably our last hope of them Arsenal dropping points.
Man, the amount of disrespect that's been heaped upon Manchester United after what they did to Liverpool is just, it blows my mind. You do realise in the build up to the Liverpool games, everybody said exactly the same thing. And Scousers couldn't beat them twice. They went to Old Trafford, they couldn't beat them.
Look, maybe I'm biased because, you know, I grew up just fucking hating them and
you can't bring yourself to will a Man United win even when you need it.
I mean, I can, but just their recent games against Burnley, Sheffield, I mean, they are so bad. They are better against the bigger teams. I think that is fair. Ten Hag's record does show that. But no, I think Bournemouth is our best chance of Arsenal dropping points.
Okay, George, do you think that Bournemouth is, so do you feel that you need Arsenal to drop points? That's my first question. How sort of are you focused just on City's games and the kind of the idea that, well, we'll just win our games and we'll do that and we'll win the league, or have you got one eye on it'd be nice if they drop points somewhere?
My heart is saying no, City. I'm just concentrating on City. It's in our hands. We win every game. We win the league. Simple maths. But my head is definitely keeping one eye on the fixtures. And yeah, I probably share Lloyd's faith in United and their ability to get a result against Arsenal. But as you said, stranger things have happened. And this season, they've done the Scousers twice. So why can't they do Arsenal in a one-off match? We'll see. I'm not too confident Bournemouth are going to get anything from this match purely because it's at the Emirates. I think if Bournemouth were at home and they could, you know, make things tricky for them, maybe I would be a bit more hopeful. But I think with Arsenal being at home, it is a 12:30 and spooky things can happen in those matches. But I'm trying to just always focus on City and across the weekend, I think, especially the Sunday matches, if they go our way, if Spurs lose and Villa win, then Villa will have secured the Champions League and Spurs will be out of it, and therefore there won't be anything on the line for Spurs when we go to play them midweek. So that's kind of more where I'm focusing on in terms of wanting the results. Obviously, I want Arsenal to lose as well, but I think that's maybe the more realistic way of calming my nerves this weekend.
Lloyd?
Yeah, I think there's a chance. There are a few things that stack up. Bournemouth have been brilliant. The 12:30 is always a bit of a stinker. I think in your home games, ideally, you want what we're going to have at Wolves, which is later kickoff, give everyone a bit more time, a few more beers. Players have always said they prefer kind of playing a bit later. It just always feels to me like the banana skin potential in a 12:30. I still expect Arsenal to win, but Bournemouth have really kind of mixed it this season. And the thing that they've managed to turn around from November is they were so open with the way that they press under Iraola, and teams were kind of just carving through them. And Lewis Cook did an interview about it, saying it kind of clicked around about then. And since then, they've been one of the top teams in the league at kind of regaining the ball in the final third.
Yeah.
And if you can run at that Arsenal defence, isolate, you know, Gabriel, I don't think he's the best on the turn. You know, whoever they play at left back has been a little bit of a kind of rotating kind of horse this season. I wouldn't rule it out. But I'm not going to be sat there like I was for the Villa game, where there was a little bit of expectation rather than hope.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, I kind of, my view on on that game tomorrow more than anything is just, I think what you can't do is you can't let Arsenal take the lead in the first half. I think if you want to, if I'm looking at it from a Bournemouth fan's point of view and sort of what's the route out of that stadium with a point, well, the route out of that stadium with a point is to make sure that it's 0-0 at half time, because I think you want Arsenal to feel some pressure. And I think that 0-0 on the hour mark, for example, Arsenal will begin to feel pressure. And I think the other side of that, when you get to this point in the title race, and I've seen it with the Scousers, and actually to some extent, I've seen it a little bit with City as well. When you get to this point in a title race, and you're particularly and you're playing at home, and you know you got to win the game, the further into the game you get at it being 0-0, the more you feel the scoreboard pressure, the more gung-ho you become. And actually, that's when you're at your most susceptible to giving up a stupid goal on the counter-attack. And so I think if flip side, if Arsenal score in the first 25 minutes, it's curtains for Bournemouth. I'm sure about that. But give me 0-0 at half time and I might just tune in for the second half to see how the rest of it unfolds. Lloyd, I didn't ask you how you feeling. Like, how are your nerves? Like, what's your mindset like having been here before?
Yeah, a lot calmer than, you know, any Arsenal fan is feeling. I think you saw when Liverpool lost to Palace, I think you saw a bit in that Arsenal performance, the pressure of it then being in their hands and them kind of being the front runners. They've not been in that position before, kind of at this stage of a title race. I think you see it from the fans. I don't know about you lot, but like I'm around a lot of Arsenal fans living in London, and you know they just don't have that belief or the bottle. Like, a lot of them just can't handle a title race, to be honest. So yeah, I'm calmer. We've done it before, but we've had hiccups before. You know, think about the Villa game 2 years ago. Like, that wasn't plain sailing. We'd won the games. We'd put ourselves in a good position, and yet that performance in the first half happened. You know, QPR. There's been examples, so I'm still very aware that there's definitely a chance City could drop a point or two, well, two, isn't it, in the next four games. But the job is simple in that you just go game to game, win the game, tick one off, win the game, tick one off. And we know, like George said, if we win all four, doesn't matter what Arsenal do, Arsenal can slap everyone 10-0 and we'll still win the league.
Yeah. Yeah, I find myself calmer than I have been in any other title race, and I find that odd because of how much I want to win. Because I think that winning four on the bounce, something that nobody's done before, is something that's really important to me. I think it's something that cements this team. This team will already go down in history, but it cements this team's place and Guardiola's place in the kind of pantheon of greats as the greatest to come through the Premier League. So, but yeah, I think maybe because we're not in the Champions League, and so there is that sense of like, well, for the first time in ages, it's just like a game a week. Maybe it's the fact that the fixtures on paper don't feel that hard. The fact that Liverpool kind of, you know, basically fell on their own emotional sword in the last few weeks and killed themselves from a title race point of view, and it's kind of left us and Arsenal, and Arsenal don't feel like awful. Like, it just, someone asked me, I don't know, like 6 months ago, who would you rather win the league if it wasn't City? And for me, it's like, that's a really easy question. Arsenal all day long. We definitely did not want Jurgen going out with the Premier League title. So maybe all of that stuff kind of coalesces into a place where I just feel relatively calm. And I feel, you know, my confidence level of can City win their remaining games is 7.5 to 8 out of 10. That's my confidence level. And I think that's a good spot to be.
Can I ask you a question then? Same for George. So bearing in mind you've just said 7.5 to 8, what's your confidence level of Arsenal winning their remaining three? Are you more confident that Arsenal will do that, or are you more confident that City?
No chance. I think you've
everybody is massively, massively underestimating Old Trafford. I can't get my head around how anybody looks at the way that they performed against Liverpool and thinks that they're going to roll over for Arsenal. They won't do that. The thing about United, right, which I think suits us in this game, is that they're a weird team. Why are they weird? Because they're not very good, but at the same time, they'll score goals in multiples in games that they've been terrible. I've watched United be fucking abject for 95 minutes and score 3 goals. And you kind of sat there going, how did they score 3 goals? But they just do it. And so I don't see a world in which that's an easier game than us going to Spurs.
So you're more confident that City would win 4 versus Arsenal win 3?
I'm more confident that City get more out of the Spurs stadium than Arsenal do out of Old Trafford.
Okay, nicely dodged, George.
Yeah, the 3 fixtures, obviously the Bournemouth, United and Everton. It's a real shame for us, not for Everton fans, that Everton have now safe, because that could have really been a tricky fixture of them if Everton needed any kind of points on the last day. That's kind of what would have been ideal for City fans. So I think, you know, the Everton match, that's 3 points for Arsenal. Everton will just be relieved all day and just won't probably be bothered about what really happens on the pitch. They'll be already looking at next season. United, you'd hope they'd have some kind of personal pride and pride in the club, and they wouldn't want, you know, Arsenal to win the league at Old Trafford again, like they did all the way back in 2002. So, but I just don't have any faith in this United team at all. I mean, they play like
Arsenal like they hate Liverpool as well, from a fan's perspective.
United play like the quality wise, they're a bottom 3 team in this league, and yet for whatever reason, they're somehow in the top 7. Like, it doesn't make any kind of, you know, it goes against all the laws of physics and everything in the universe how United is somehow in the top half, but they are. So we can rely on maybe this kind of freakish power that they've got this year to maybe they can pull off one more mad victory. We'll keep everything crossed, but I'm not so sure. So I probably, out of the 3 teams Arsenal got left to face, I have probably the most faith in Bournemouth, but because it's at home at Arsenal, I'm expecting 3 Arsenal wins, to be honest. But I am also as confident City can win all theirs as well. So I'd put them on equal playing field, really. Maybe a bit of a cop-out answer, but I'm equally confident either way.
Okay. I've got a lot of faith in my red brothers from Salford now. I might end up looking Jesus a mug. God. I might end up looking a mug, which is all right, because I often end up looking a mug. But, you know, so far this season, I feel as though I've done all right in kind of reading the tea leaves of how the season has unfolded. So
I do really admire this manifestation of this United victory. This is the most positive I've ever heard you speak about United.
Honestly, the way Aysan speaks about United, this is incredible.
So it's a big break from the usual kind of dialogue around them. So I do admire this manifestation and, you know, just pure willpower into this big victory at Old Trafford.
No, but everything I've said is sort of true, right? They are truly an awful football team, but they do, like, in a mad way, you do watch games where you go, they've scored 3 goals, how did they do that? And I don't know. There's weirder things for me. Stranger things have happened than Man United getting a point at Old Trafford against Arsenal, a really poor Man United getting a point against a really good Arsenal at Old Trafford. Stranger things have happened. But I think our listeners are probably sick of hearing about that now, because they're probably all agreeing with you two going, he's off his head. So let's talk about Wolves. Lloyd, Gary O'Neill, done an all right job, considering, first 4 weeks of the season, everybody was like, oh yeah, the manager that Bournemouth sacked. Do you know what I mean? That's
That's pretty much how he was being described. So how good a job has he done?
I think he's done a great job. I'd give him a bit more praise than what you have. No one's been done dirtier than Wolves on VAR decisions this season. I mean, started off with the Onana punch to the head in the first game of the entire season.
Oh, yeah.
I can't remember which Wolves player that was, but that was an absolute howler. They've had, I think, four games when they probably should have gained points from four terrible kind of VAR decisions littered through games. I think they should have, spoke to a Wolves fan about it, he thinks they should have between like basically 6 to 8 more points, which if you added that to where they are in the league, I think makes you kind of give O'Neill even more props. I thought his interview when he went on Monday Night Football halfway through the season and he spoke about how he dismantled Bournemouth at the time, I thought was incredibly impressive. I think he's come across really well in interviews. Wolves hardly invested over the summer and he's really had to deal with kind of what they've got. I think he's done really well. I think he could be an outside bet for the England job if Southgate leaves, to be honest. I know it's a bit early, but what he did with Bournemouth, what he's done with Wolves, I have been impressed. So yeah, I'm a big fan of him.
George?
Yeah, likewise. I've been impressed with him this year. All Wolves games are pretty enjoyable to watch on the whole. Sometimes they're maybe a little open, and I think maybe, you know, I don't want to jinx things, but maybe we're playing them more at the right time. I do think the confidence has been knocked after that kind of, you know, mad FA Cup quarterfinal against Coventry when they were losing for a lot of the game, then pulled it back and then obviously lost 3-2 in mad circumstances with the last kicks of the game. Since then, the form's not been brilliant, but I don't think the blame lies with O'Neill. As Lloyd said, they've not really invested much in the squad, and they did lose, you know, Ruben Neves has been one of their most important players, for a number of years, kind of the proper anchor for them in the midfield. And so to move on from him and, you know, have a good season, I think Wolves fans would have, they were very pessimistic from what I remember at the start of the season, especially when O'Neill first got the job. So I think, you know, if you told them they could be 11th with a chance of being top half this season, I think they would have shook your hand off. Obviously, they've seen higher highs with the Nuno Europa League days, but I think they've got a great core of players. And I think O'Neill seems to have both the man management side of things and the tactical side of things. And I think those are two things that will serve him very well, being able to play both sides of the kind of managerial game. And yeah, I think if he's given a little bit of money to spend in the summer, address a few problem areas on the pitch, I think he can maybe, you know, he could make them push for probably a Conference League place next year.
How does City approach this? I'm interested in the week off. I'm interested in whether that week off is good or bad in terms of rhythm and momentum and all of those things. Also, from a team selection point of view, I'm interested in that. I don't think that there's a lot of question marks, but I think there's a couple. So, Lloyd, try and talk me through like an approach and a team that you think Guardiola will take.
So, just before that, I think there's two important things to point out. First one is O'Neill's got a touchline ban, so won't be on the touchline on Saturday. So he'll be in the stands, which generally doesn't help teams. And the other thing is that the one player that I really fear for Wolves is fucking back in training. Pedro Neto is available for the game. He, as shown in the game in the reverse fixture, I think he is one of those kind of kryptonite players for the way that we play. Thankfully, I don't think he'll be fit enough, hopefully, to start. He's been out for a while. But that's a key consideration, I think, for Pep. In picking the team, albeit he'll probably come off the bench. So, given the players that Wolves have got, and Cunha is still like an excellent ball carrier, and like Neto, someone I think could cause us problems, I'd like to see a very similar team to what we saw last out. So I wouldn't start Ruben Dias. I would keep Dias for the Fulham game, where he's going to come up against Muniz, who's very physical. And I went to the Palace Fulham game at the weekend, and he kind of really battles. And you saw that with the game that they had at United when they won in the last minute. So I'd keep Dias for that game. I'd stick with Akanji, Walker, maybe see if Stones wants to come in for Ake. And then I would play Gvardiol. I'd play Rodri with Foden and KDB in the middle. And then I would play Bernardo. I would play Doku, but I expect it will be Jack. And then Haaland up top.
George?
Yeah, probably a very, very similar team to what Lloyd's just laid out there. The question marks, Matt, you know, over will Edison start again? He has been training as normal, all the reports. Will he, obviously they will be going into negotiations with Ortega for a new contract. Will Pep throw him a bone and give him the shirt and, you know, show how much he values him, or will he go straight back to Edison, seeing as it's a running and he wants to always play his most serious 11? That's where I'd be looking to start with, and kind of maybe the first change from the Forest match. I agree with Lloyd. I think the back line, you want the pace there to protect you from the counter-attack, especially if Neto's back, Huang playing, all those kinds of things. So Walker, Akanji, Ake, Gvardiol. The Stones question's a big one. I think we said it last week, Asan, like Stones has been on the bench a lot, but he's not featured or started for a while. It's a bit strange, but is that for a reason? Should we just keep it as that? If he is carrying a niggle of some sort, there's no point rushing it. We've seen what happens when you rush players who are injury prone, with, you know, maybe Kev, the start of the season, the prime example. And then, yeah, from the midfield, I think Rodri, I think you'd like to see Foden come straight back in, Kev, Bernardo on the right, Haaland up top, and... I would go with Doku myself, because I think if they are going to push up on the counter, then it'd be nice to have a weapon going back the other way, but it will most likely be Grealish. But that's, yeah, very similar to Lloyd, to be honest. What about you?
I hope it's not Grealish. That's my starting point on the left wing. I want to see Doku play on the left wing. I quite like the idea of playing Bernardo on the right, Rodri, KDB, Phil in the middle, Doku left wing. I'd be looking at it like this, where I'd go, you know what, Walker's going to play, so I'll play Akanji, Dias, Ake along with Walker. And then I'd give Doku the kind of the left wing, and then I'd pick the midfield that I've said, and obviously I'd play Erling up top. That'd be the way that I would unpeel this onion. I'll throw a mad one in. Honestly, it genuinely would not shock me if Alvarez and Haaland both start.
Alvarez in the... So if you bring in, like, obviously Haaland will be up top, where would you be put? Do you reckon Alvarez would be going in, into the midfield role or on the left?
I don't know is the honest answer. I can see... You know, I don't know. I've got no idea, because I can never quite figure out what his positioning is, but it wouldn't shock me if Alvarez started. I wonder if Pep just looks at this game and goes, I just want everybody who can potentially score a goal to be on that pitch. But then it was more a case of Kev being out, which led to Alvarez starting games with Haaland. Although that very first game of the season, was De Bruyne already out for that, or did he get injured in that game?
Injured in the Burnley.
He got injured in the game.
And did Alvarez and Haaland both start that game?
No, I think Alvarez came on for Kev, didn't he? When he got injured. I have to check.
I'm gonna check that right now, because I'm genuinely...
No, Alvarez did start.
That's what I thought. I had a feeling that first game of the season.
Yeah, first team of the season was Edison, Net, Walker, Akanji, Ake, Rico, Rodri, Kev, Alvarez, Bernardo on the right, Foden left, Haaland up top.
Interesting. Well, yeah, it wouldn't shock me if he found a way to shoehorn Alvarez into that team. Do either of you think that Mateus Nunes will get a start against his old club?
I can't see it at this stage.
Next question. cheeky. All right, next question. Mr. Next question. It's the last question. Give me a score prediction and we'll wrap this up.
I'll go for the most given score prediction on these pods by me this season, which is 3-1, because I don't think we'll keep a clean sheet.
George?
I'm gonna back the defence. I'm gonna say 2-0 with Foden grabbing a goal to put the icing on the cake for him this week.
I'm gonna go 3-0 Haaland hat trick. Silence the little minority of doubters that have doubted the robot this season. Right, lovely. Friday show's over. We can now enjoy our bank holiday weekend. Let the bank holiday weekend commence, as they would say. George, thank you very much.
No, thanks for having me. Have a good one, guys.
Lloyd, nice one.
Is it a bank holiday in Ibiza?
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
Ibiza? Didn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, if it isn't, I've decided that it is. So yeah, everybody that I work with is in London and nobody's going to be working on Monday. So I'll definitely be having Monday off.
Fair. Good for you.
Right. Everybody who listened, thank you very much. This was the Friday show, 9320 podcast. As you all know, the 9320 player is there with loads more content. So go and check it out. In the meantime, be safe, be well. And as always, up the Blues.